This is East End Inc. Today we present portions of a community reading of the work of Afro-American writers conducted at the John Germain Library in Sag Harbor this month. It was jointly sponsored by the library and Canio's Cultural Cafe. To start, here is Reverend Kimberly Johnson.
I'm Reverend Kimberly Johnson. I am minister of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the South Fork. And I have been traveling these past 2 weeks. I spent last week in Birmingham on a bit of a civil rights tour, and the week before in Tucson doing some border witness. And so I was trying to think of how to put these two stories together. From Birmingham, the story of Black people in a country that often doesn't seem to want them. And from Tucson, the story of people who are forced to leave home. And so I have this poem called Home by Worshen Shear, which is a little bit of a liberty because though she is Black, she is from Somali. She's not American. She is Somali and British. And this is her poem, Home. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. Your neighbors running faster than you. The boy you went to school with, who kissed you dizzy behind the old tin factory, is holding a gun bigger than his body. You only leave home when home won't let you stay. No one would leave home unless home chased you. Fire under feet, hot blood in belly. It's not something you ever thought about doing. And so when you did, you carried the anthem under your breath, waiting until the airport toilet to tear up the passport and swallow. Each mouthful of paper making it clear that you would not be going back. You have to understand. No one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. Who would choose to spend days and nights in the stomach of a truck unless the miles traveled meant something more than the journey? No one would choose to crawl under fences, be beaten until your shadow leaves you, raped, then drowned, forced to the bottom of the boat because you are darker, to be sold, starved, shot at the border like a sick animal, be pitied, lose your name, lose your family. Make a refugee camp a home for a year or two or 10. Stripped and searched. Find prison everywhere, and if you survive, and you are greeted on the other side with go home Blacks, refugees, dirty immigrants, asylum seekers, sucking our country dry of milk, dark with their hands out, smell strange, savage. Look what they've done to their own countries. What will they do to ours? The dirty looks in the street, softer than the limb torn off. The indignity of everyday life, more tender than 14 men who look like your father between your legs. Insults, easier to swallow than rubble, than your child's body in pieces. For now, forget about pride. Your survival is more important. I want to go home. But home is the mouth of a shark. Home is the barrel of the gun. And no one would leave home unless home chased you to the shore, unless home tells you to leave what you could not behind, even if it is human. No one leaves home until home is a damp voice in your ear saying, leave, run now. I don't know what I've become.
I'm Nancy Myers, and I'm going to read the poem The Sculptor by Nikki Grimes. No accident of birth or race or place determines the scope of hope or dreams I have a right to. I inventory my head and heart to weigh and measure what talents I might use to make my own tomorrow. It all depends on the grit at my disposal. My father says hard work is the clay dreams are molded from. Yes, molded. Dreams do not come. They are carved, muscled into something solid, something true.
I'd like to introduce you to Everett Hoagland, who is professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in North Dartmouth. He was poet laureate in New Bedford, Massachusetts in the 90s, and the New Bedford Symphony put one of his poems to music with 200 voices. He went to Africa twice to search out his family, and he found one whose name was Ayen, who told him all about his great-grandmother. So he wrote this poem for Ayen, in memory of my great-grandmother, Martha Prattis Nichols Brown, who lived to be 111 years old. And it's called Here. H-E-R-E. She rose from the rocker, unfolded the Afro-American article, pointed it out. Lord, this world's a mess. Folks fighting to be called most oppressed. Black folk, women folk, old folk. Who's most oppressed? Me, I guess. Got it all. Being as I'm old, black woman. But so what? Whining never got even a kid more than candy or a pat on the head, nor a yard dog a kick or a bone. Struggle and strife are the facts of life. Your hardworking grandpa's dead, but you are the afterlife of his labor. Our work has been our worship. So take our tattered, threadbare patchwork, hope, and work with it. Yes, kneel to God, but stand up to people who fight your right to the life God give you. Some say home is where the heart is. That's true if heart is courage, strength, and faith. 'Cause in this life, home is wherever your struggle is, and son, the work's undone. We just cleared the ground, plowed and planted, the weeding, watering, watching, waiting. The long work is up to you. We ain't no ways through. So yes, keep the faith, but keep the farm too. Hold on to home ground and learn that living should be learning too. Remember what Fred Douglas read and wrote for you, and Robeson, your Malcolm X and Dr. King. The main thing written clear right amongst these headlines here. The whole world's your home. Here, here. Undoing the Do is the name of this one. Yes, as we have sung, we are overcoming and have come a long way to get where we are today. But we are not beyond the American right of unrighteous, right-wing racism. Rightfully, we rap. We brag on how we are survivors. Yes, we have survived. Some relative few among us even flourish. To survive centuries of social hells, we had to adapt to them by light of church and cross burnings in our souls. Adapting to hells so well, some to some extent have emerged from them somewhat hellish for from the history by grand design. In mind, self-generating slaves, salving festering sores with the calming balm of things. So as we celebrate Black History and Herstory Month, we need to free our designedly fractious, ununited selves from the bling thing, from escapist narcissism. For ourselves, we need to ask why we want, we need to live large instead of abundantly. Why we feel we need to buy, to have, to drink, to use, to dye, or bleach, or fry, or straighten some of the things we do. And why we do some of the things we do to and with ourselves and one another. Everett Hoagland.
I would like to introduce you to Venture Smith. He is credited with writing the first autobiography, A Black Person Enslaved, and published it at his own expense in 1798. And it is a full accounting of his capture as a boy in Africa at the age of about 9 or 10, and the Middle Passage experience, and his enslavement, his purchase of his own freedom, and later the freedom of his family, and his outstanding success in terms of people in Connecticut at the time, where he became what we would call today a prominent citizen. I thought I would read two little sections. The first is the preface from his book, and this is actually accredited to his son, not of a renowned politician or a warrior, an untutored African slave brought into this Christian country at 8 years of age, wholly destitute of all education but what he received in common with other domesticated animals, enjoying no advantages that could lead him to suppose himself superior to the beasts, his fellow servants. So I'm going to read a section where he actually purchases his freedom. The next summer, I again desired he would give me a chance of some going to work. But he refused and answered that he must have my labor this summer, as he did not have it in the past winter. I replied that I considered it as hard that I could not have a chance to work out when the season became advantageous, and that I must only be permitted to hire myself out in the poorest season of the year. He asked me after this what I would give him for the privilege per month. I replied that I would leave it wholly with his own generosity to determine what I should return him every month. "Well then," said he, "if £2 a month might be considered." I answered him that if that was the least he would take, I would be contented. Accordingly, I hired myself out at Fisher's Island and earned £20, £13.6, of which my master drew for the privilege, and the remainder I paid him for my freedom. This made £51.2, which I paid him. In October following, I went and wrought 6 months at Long Island. In that 6 months' time, I cut and quartered 400 cords of wood, besides threshing out 25 bushels of grain, and received of my wages down only £20, which left remaining a larger sum. Whilst I was out that time, I took up on my wages only one pair of shoes. At night, I lay on the hearth with one coverlet over and another under me. I returned to my master and gave him what I received of my 6 months' labor. This left only £13.18 to make up the full sum for my redemption. My master liberated me, saying that I might pay what was behind if I could ever make it convenient. Otherwise, it would be well. The amount of the money which I had paid my master towards redeeming my time was £71.02. The reason of my master for asking such an unreasonable price was, he said, to secure himself in case I should ever come to want. Being 36 years old, I left Colonel Smith once and for all. I had already been sold 3 different times, made considerable money with seemingly nothing to derive it from, been cheated out of a large sum of money, lost much by misfortunes, and paid an enormous sum for my freedom.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to a community reading of the work of Afro-American writers recorded at the John Germain Library in Sag Harbor this month. We heard Reverend Kimberly Johnson, Nancy Myers, Reverend Edda Lorello, and Bill Chaliff. Continuing, here is poet Ursula Heggie.
Audre Lorde is one of my favorite poets, and she has a way of, even if she is really angry or upset or devastated by something, she turns somehow toward the light. And it's not in any kind of Pollyannish way. It's deserved, and it's joyous, and... So this poem is called Girlfriend, and it was written March 27, 1990, about 2 years before Audre Lorde died. Girlfriend, it's almost a year, and I still can't deal with you not being at the end of the line. I read your name in memorial poems and think they must be insane, mistaken, malicious. In terrible error, just plain wrong. Not that there haven't been times before, months passing, madly, sadly, we not speaking. Get off my case, will you, please? Oh, just lighten up. But I can't get you out of my air, my spirit, my special hotline phone book. Is this what it means to live forever? When will I not miss picking up the receiver? After a pregnancy of silence, one of us, born again, with a brand new address or poem, miffed because the other doesn't jump at the sound of her beloved voice. There's a shorter poem called Lunar Eclipse that was written about half a year before that. I don't know if it's written to the same friend, to the same girlfriend, but it has the voice that to me would suggest that. Lunar Eclipse. Last night I watched the moon go out, become a dark opalescent glow. I could not believe what was happening, even as I saw the change in light. The first time I met you, we sat up all night reading each other's poems. Morning hopes followed us down Cold Street. Morning hopes followed us down Cold Street, charring like a flock of quits. You stretch across our best years like a living wire between heaven and hell at war. Being sisters wasn't always easy, but it was never dull. I can't believe you are gone, out of my life, so you're not.
My name is Daria Wisnan, and I wrote this poem after speaking to my sister, who's married to a man who's quite large. He's 6 feet four and brown-skinned and hard to miss. So she had mentioned that he had been in line in a store or something, and waiting in line, and a woman said, "Oh, I didn't see you." And I found that hard to fathom, how one could miss a 6 foot four, dark-skinned man. So this is my poem. It says, "I am black as can be. How is it you don't see me? I am the invisible man in your society. I am brown. You've seen me around, waiting at the train station, but I'm not going anywhere. I am red. I'm still here, though you wanted me dead. Hidden away on the res, out of sight, out of my mind, trying to survive your beneficence."
I'm going to read from Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson, a story of justice and redemption. He's a lawyer who works to free people who have been wrongly accused. This is from the introduction. "I grew up in a poor, rural, racially segregated settlement on the eastern shore of the Delmarva Peninsula in Delaware, where the racial history of this country casts a long shadow. The coastal communities that stretched from Virginia and eastern Maryland to lower Delaware were unapologetically Southern. Many people in the region insisted on a racialized hierarchy that required symbols, markers, and constant reinforcement, in part because of the area's proximity to the North. Confederate flags were proudly displayed throughout the region, boldly and defiantly marking the cultural, social, and political landscape. African Americans lived in racially segregated ghettos isolated by railroad tracks within small towns or in colored sections in the country. I grew up in a country settlement where some people lived in tiny shacks. Families without indoor plumbing had to use outhouses. We shared our outdoor play space with chickens and pigs. The black people around me were strong and determined, but marginalized and excluded. The poultry plant bus came each day to pick up adults and take them to the factory where they would daily pluck, hack, and process thousands of chickens. My father left the area as a teenager because there was no local high school for black children. He returned with my mother and found work in a food factory. On weekends, he did domestic work at beach cottages and rentals. My mother had a civilian job at an Air Force base. It seemed that we were all cloaked in an unwelcome garment of racial difference that constrained, confined, and restricted us. My relatives worked hard all the time but never seemed to prosper. My grandfather was murdered when I was a teenager, but it didn't seem to matter much to the world outside our family. My grandmother was the daughter of people who were enslaved in Caroline County, Virginia. She was born in the 1880s, her parents in the 1840s. Her father talked to her all the time about growing up in slavery and how he learned to read and write but kept it a secret. He hid the things he knew until emancipation. The legacy of slavery very much shaped my grandmother and the way she raised her 9 children. It influenced the way she talked to me, the way she constantly told me to keep close. When I visited her, she would hug me so tightly I could barely breathe. After a little while, she would ask me, 'Brian, do you still feel me hugging you?' If I said yes, she'd let me be. If I said no, she would assault me again. I said no a lot because it made me happy to be wrapped in her formidable arms. She never tired of pulling me to her. 'You can't understand most of the important things from a distance, Brian. You have to get close,' she told me all the time. The distance I experienced in my first year of law school made me feel lost. Proximity to the condemned, to people unfairly judged. That was what guided me back to something that felt like home." So he tells the story of Walter McMillan, who was on death row, and he ultimately was responsible for getting him freed, but after 50 years of incarceration. Walter's story is one of many that I tell in the following chapters. I've represented abused and neglected children who were prosecuted as adults and suffered more abuse and mistreatment after being placed in adult facilities. I've represented women whose numbers in prison have increased 640% in the last 30 years, and seen how our hysteria about drug addiction and our hostility to the poor have made us quick to criminalize and prosecute poor women when a pregnancy goes wrong. I've represented mentally disabled people whose illnesses have often landed them in prison for decades. I've gotten close to victims of violent crime and their families, and witnessed how even many of the custodians of mass imprisonment, prison staff, have been made less healthy, more violent and angry, and less just and merciful.
My name is Gordon Galliano. I thought of someone whom we don't necessarily associate with readings, Muhammad Ali. So these are a couple of quotes of his. Impossible is just a big word thrown around by small men who find it easier to live in the world they've been given than to explore the power they have to change it. Impossible is not a fact, it's an opinion. Impossible is not a declaration, it's a dare. Impossible is potential. Impossible is temporary. Impossible is nothing. The service you do for others is the rent you pay for your room here on earth. What you're thinking is what you're becoming. Only a person who knows what it is like to be defeated can reach down to the bottom of his or her soul and come up with the extra ounce of power it takes to win when the match is even. And then this is in protest against being drafted for the Vietnam War. This could almost be paraphrased, substituting a few words for today. Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam, while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights? No, I'm not going 10,000 miles from home to help murder and burn another poor nation simply to continue the domination of white slave masters over the darker people of the world. This is the day when such evils must come to an end. I have been warned that to take such a stand would cost me millions of dollars, but I have said it once and I will say it again. The real enemy of my people is here. I will not disgrace my religion, my people, or myself by becoming a tool to enslave those who are fighting for their own justice, freedom, and equality.
We heard portions of a community reading from the work of Afro-American writers recorded at Sag Harbor's John Germain Library in February 2019. The readers were Bill Chaliff, Bobby Cohen, Gordon Galliano, Ursula Heggie, Reverend Kimberly Johnson, Reverend Edda Lorello, Nancy Myers, Daria Wishnia, and Wanda Miller of the John Germain Library. East End Inc. programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Wanda Miller of the John Germain Library. This is Hazel Khan.